Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is poet and educator Jerry Merskin. Merskin is currently an associate professor in the Department of Writing at Ithaca College. His poems have appeared in many literary journals, including the Seneca Review, Midwest Quarterly, and Arts and Letters. He was the winner of the Mammoth Books Prize for Poetry, a national poetry competition, and has had three collections published by Mammoth, including his new collection, Crepuscular Non-Driveway, which was released this year. And welcome to the show, Jerry.
Thanks, Tish. Thanks for having me.
Now, this new collection reads not so much like poetry, but almost like short stories. Huh. Were you trying to deliberately get away from a poetic form and create something new?
Yeah, and it's interesting you picked up on that because I actually wrote the pieces almost in flash form, a creative nonfiction, and that really worked for me, especially creating a kind of fluency. I found that my poetry did sort of evolve from a lyric to a narrative form, and I like it. I think when I was starting out, I wanted to create an oral sensation, and now I'm more interested in a pedestrian intensity and see if I can, you know, go a little further.
Well, it seems very intimate, like you're really speaking to someone instead of somebody trying to figure out what a poetic form means, you know? It really feels very accessible.
Yeah, and that's important to me. That's exactly it. And I think we instantly understand story, and that's what I'm going for.
Yeah, well, it certainly does work. Now, where did you come up with this title?
Oh, okay.
Crepuscular Non-Driveway. It's almost like it means there's nothing there or something,
okay.
You know?
So when you read the poem in the book, you find out I tell a whole story of wanting to cast a spell. But, I didn't have to choose that particular poem as the eponymous poem, but I did because I think that poetry or poets want to cast a spell. They want their poetry to be a kind of incantation. But I'm also interested in, you know, my immature self. and so that poem sort of explores that. And I'm trying to cast a spell. And as I reflect on that, you know, something emerges. So that poem was central for me. I think it told the story of what I'm doing in my writing in general. So I chose that.
But crepuscular means, you know, resembling twilight or something. And then non-driveway. It's almost like I want you to go into the darkness where there's not really anything there. That's what the title felt like to me in some ways.
Right. Well, it's sort of like something in the moment will clear everything up. And, you know, if I could find the right words. I get a recommendation from my bandmate, Evan D. Williams, who said, use that as the title. And I said, yeah, okay.
So, yeah, it catches the eye. People go, what?
Right. And also, I don't know if you read the article in the Times, but Bill Chason reviewed the book, and he said, that's the only $64 word. And I appreciated that, because what I'm trying to do is not actually, you know, elude the reader. So I got that out of the way with the title.
Yeah. A lot of academic poetry does do that. You're not really communicating, except for maybe with somebody in a professor who's going to judge you that way.
Right.
Now, I want to have you read from Crepuscular Non-Driveway. This one's called Batting Cleanup.
I'm surprised you picked this one. I wouldn't have chosen this one as one to read, but I like it. And maybe it's because it sort of lives on the edge of my own understanding and it sort of works. I have this epigraph from Roger Federer who said, "Don't tell me to be quiet. When I want to talk, I talk." And the poem sort of is about that in some way, sort of asserting what needs to be asserted, whether or not, you know, it's acceptable or not. It also is a poem that I like, too, because so many of the poems are sort of moments of encounter with another person. And I'm doing something and with them in the world through that sort of, I want to say, like a kind of parallax. Through them, I sort of see something I might not have seen.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, I'd like to read this poem, Batting Cleanup. We were walking the dogs, strolling arm in arm like men might in Italy, advancing through the narrow streets of life. The sidewalk was a stage, and we were the main players. The lighting must have been good because I didn't notice. I hardly notice. This might be surprising given that I've published poems, but I hardly ever look up to the sky with any real interest and wonder. What's going on there? There's nothing up there for me. Well, maybe every few years when we go camping and we're sitting around, I might take a peek. I might try to identify a constellation, and I'll promise to do that more often. In the end, that airy nothing does fine without me. The dog, the sixth sense, walked a few feet ahead of us. It seemed to understand how to let men walk and talk arm in arm like in Italy. When it stopped to relieve itself, my friend released my arm and went down on his hands and knees. I said, "I'll get it." He said, "No." My friend is blind. With his hand in a plastic bag, he scoured the sidewalk, searching the hard surface for the dog's waste. Then he stood, oriented, and found a city trash can. I know his blindness is not tragic, though there are forms of blindness that are. Blindness that makes you want to take a bat and beat it against a wall. You read it in the news every day. My friend did not want me to clean up for him. I understood. It's like if you see me smashing my bat against a wall, you can assume I believe that there is more to this ball game than meets the eye. But it's not that I want something to come down and intervene. That would be tragic. I mean, we're already so involved, hanging by the tails of our basic natures. Anything that fusses with the design might just tip the scales. I realize that's abstract, but in some way, that's the way it's got to be. For to engage this life in even the smallest of gestures, like taking a walk, is to leave all theorizing behind and step onto the sidewalk of the real world, the place the dog relieves itself, where a man goes down on his knees, or another swings a bat, beating it against one of the two walls of life, the visible one, the hard one, beneath what today is a clear blue sky.
It's great. You talk about how you don't care about the sky, but you end by acknowledging it. I love that.
I'm always talking
such
about that.
Such a poet, denying, yeah, you know, some of the gifts of nature, yeah, that actually probably inspire you.
Yeah, well, it's like right at that eye level, the beginning of that infinity, and we hardly ever look up there. That's why I love the image of the baseball cap, you know, sort of living on ground level.
Yeah. I'm constantly looking up at the sky, looking for reassurance.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
The nothingness sort of gives me hope because I feel like I'm filled with something at least.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of wonder up there.
Yeah.
You live in the country, right?
Well, I live in a place where we have some land, and I can lay on the grass and look up at the sky.
That's great. Hold on.
Yeah, I am, for dear life. Now, were these poems coming to you really rapidly, or did it take a lot of work to finish them and complete them and make them whole?
I felt that the narrative form works a little more fluently for me, if I had already sort of internalized the story. But, you know, it took a few years of collecting the pieces. I used about 70% of the things I collected for this book. And right up until the end, I was changing things around and adding things.
Mm-hmm. And did you know this was going to be a complete book?
I didn't. No, I was actually surprised that I had the book. When I did, I thought it was going to take me a few more years. But it felt whole.
Yeah.
You know, the poet James Wright said that a book of poems should be 35 pages. So. Like, and, you know, when you say that, everybody shakes their head and says, that's about right.
I've talked to a lot of poets who say the I in poems is not necessarily them. But the poems in this book do seem really personal. Are they, though? I mean, are they autobiographical?
The poems are autobiographical, but the I is sort of the character of myself.
Ah.
That's a great question, you know, and people ask me, is everything in this book true? Well, yeah, you know, poets don't make much up, and memoirs don't make much up.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not exactly the speaker. I'm pretty close to the speaker.
And so who is that? Is that you standing beside yourself and watching?
I think it's the part of me that needs to understand something, that doesn't quite get it all.
Mm.
And the poem becomes an occasion of that understanding for that part of myself.
Yeah.
So it's almost like through the writing of it, I'll join those two parts, myself.
So many people I've talked to said that poetry is a way to discover. You know, it's a mysterious language, and sometimes you don't even know that you're writing something real or true.
Yeah,
that you go, whoa, did I write that?
I remember Ken McLean, who teaches at Cornell.
Oh, yes, I've had him on.
He said, what did he say? Living is one thing, but poetry, that's something else. I think that's what he was talking about.
I want to have you read another from Crepuscular Non-Driveway. This one's called Ninth.
I had fun reading this one. My mother was in the audience, and I was just about to read the poem, and I realized she never heard the story of my juvenile delinquency. But, you know, it was benign. And again, I think, like a lot of the poems in the book, I'm sort of exploring the limit of my understanding. And in this poem, again, a kind of immaturity, what I thought the world was about. And in reflection, it's sort of humorous to actually grow out of oneself. So I'm pleased that you asked me to read this one. I think the Spanish name Geronimo is Geronimo, but we would just say Geronimo. So I'm just going to say that when I read the poem. Ninth. It was ninth grade, a Spanish class, I know that, though a lot of what you're doing at that time is unknown. Our teacher, it was her first job out of college. Her name was Miss Nasberg. This was the mid-60s, rock and roll, miniskirts, the whole party was just warming up. She might have been fairly average, but we didn't know. 23 years old, she had the power. One of the first things she did was give us Spanish names. Suddenly my buddy Ray was Raimundo, and I was Geronimo. The names were part of a masquerade that complemented our immaturity. In another era, we would have been learning something like how to milk a cow or how to saw a board. But there we were, sitting in a room buzzing with boy energy. I don't remember a lot, but I remember the other kids acting like idiots. When Miss Nasberg turned to write on the board, the sight of her legs exploded in our immature brains and sent waves of hysteria across the room. every time she turned, compressed lunacy, idiots. Though for the most part she put up with us and smiled and laughed off our behavior as typical. I was okay with being typical, but there was this one time that I went a little further. I don't know what I was thinking when I sneaked into her car and hid behind the back seat. That she would take me back to her apartment and teach me what I needed to know? A private tutorial on the rites of passage? I don't know, maybe. I just thought she would think it was funny, and that would be that. I was surprised that my little plan worked as well as it did. She got in and drove out of the school parking lot and out onto the expressway without knowing that I was right behind her, waiting for the perfect moment to reveal myself, which I did at some point. At some point, I popped up my head and said, "Hi." You're probably wondering if she had a heart attack, if the car swerved and hit a tractor trailer or went flying off the road. No, it was better than that. And in retrospect, I realize she wasn't average. She had something, and expressed it perfectly when one of her students appeared in her car on the highway. Maybe she was a bit surprised, but certainly not startled, and her response made me feel that I had done the right thing. "You idiot," she said. It was a perfect response, and for a second I thought that maybe something was possible, for in class she talked to us in Spanish, but now she was talking to me in our regular language. "You idiot," she said, and I had a feeling it couldn't be any better.
I love that. How did your mother react to that?
She smiled. She was amused.
And is that teacher still alive?
You know, that's funny because I wanted to contact the teacher and say, "Hey, I wrote this poem." And I went on Facebook and I found someone with her name, and she sort of looked like Miss Nesberg. And then I realized the person that I had contacted was 29 years old. So that, you know, was about 30, 35 years late. So it was a kind of funny experience for me to realize how much time has gone by.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can tell by that poem. Which brings me to my next question. Do you find yourself becoming more reminiscent about the past as you get older? Could you have written this book 10, 15 years ago?
I think that I've always collected stories have been intrigued, but I think there's some truth to what you're saying, that the impulse to write more narratively is to sort of dwell and reflect on the past in a way.
Yeah, and make sense of it in some ways.
Yeah. And, you know, poets, they want to write. So just having that work is meaningful, and you can always go to that, you know, personal history and archive and find those stories.
Yeah.
But a lot of times you're telling the stories because they haven't been resolved, and there's something that you want to figure out.
I have found that, too. Do you find it perilous to write about people who are still alive? I mean, it seems like a lot of people in this book are parts of your family, and does it ever make you want to censor yourself?
The gratification of my father telling me that he understood all the poems in the book, which he didn't tell me the first two books. The first one he said, "Yeah, I didn't understand a lot." And then the second time he said, "Oh, there were a few I didn't understand." And then this time he said, "Yeah, I understood them all." And then he said, "But I didn't do that." And I was like, "I know what he's talking about." And I go, well, you did something. And then he said, in a funny way, he goes, "Well, you know why I did that." And we laughed a little bit. So I'm kind of telling a truth here that I think you're right. I think just in this one instance, it might be a little awkward for him. But I'm not writing out of a kind of repudiation. It's not what I'm doing again. And I think it's a fair representation. Even though I'm not sure he threw a plate. I think he might have thrown his fork down and the spaghetti went flying. And it was pretty much, in my memory, accurate.
If you're just joining us, my guest is poet Jerry Merskin. We're talking about his new collection of poetry, Crepuscular Non-Driveway. Now, you once said in an interview that as a writer you like to be goofy and you don't want to take yourself too seriously. But these poems seem pretty serious to me in many ways.
Yeah, I was thinking when I said that of what Wallace Stevens said when someone asked him what his favorite poem was. He said Emperor of Ice Cream, and when asked why, he said because it contained the essential gaudiness of poetry. And I don't think my poetry is gaudy, and I'm not trying for that precious thing. But I like to laugh at myself, and I think that's what I meant. You know, kind of silly fun with a sort of a hint of intelligence.
I think there's a little bit of an edge to some of these poems, too. Obviously, when you're trying to work something out in your life, it's not all ice cream and lollipops, you know.
Right.
So I found a little bit of an edge and a little tiny bit of kind of a darkness in some of these poems, which makes sense for somebody talking about their life who has reached a certain age, right?
Yeah. I guess you probably wouldn't want to, like, lose any shade of your experience, you know. I think you want your writing to reflect, to be comprehensive in that way. So I wouldn't want to only be goofy.
Yeah.
I want to be true to the fullness of my experience. Yeah. And I think there is a kind of sadness. I think a lot of writers write out of a kind of darker, sadder, only or lonely self. And I think I did that when I first started, but less so now.
Yeah, yeah.
Now that I'm
happily
married.
And I think it is also a way to communicate with people, because a lot of people can't communicate that darkness. They're afraid to.
Uh-huh.
Or they're not in touch with it. And then they hear a poem and they go, oh, my God,
right.
That's my experience,
right,
too.
Right, right.
I had never heard it that way.
Yeah, and I think that's what poetry can do, can make that leap between the private, the personal, and the public.
Yeah, and, yeah. And it does help people work out their demons in many ways.
Mm.
You know, it didn't help Sylvia Plath, but... Now, we were talking about this. I love this next poem from the new collection, My Father Threw a Plate. Do you want to talk a little tiny bit more about that? We were talking about autobiography, and this certainly strikes me as somewhat autobiographical.
Yeah, well, you know, when people study memory, they often say that, you know, you're going to remember things that were traumatic, and you're not going to remember those moments where you were fully engaged and happy and everything was content. So I remember this, and this is really a misdemeanor moment for my dad and for the family. And I say that in the poem. My dad's a great guy. And, you know, that's probably why I could write this poem. You know, it's just sort of, I think that poets are in the business of witnessing things and making sense of them and trying to figure out, okay, so what do I do with that knowledge? How do I absorb that?
Mm-hmm.
And how have other experiences in my life helped me absorb those other experiences, which is what happens, I think, in this poem. I'm able to compare and coordinate my experience in a way to absorb things that were more confusing or difficult.
Mm-hmm.
My father threw a plate. And I have a quote here from Wallace Stevens, poem, The Poem of the Mind. For drama, nothing beats spaghetti, especially with red sauce. If the conditions are right, the long strands hang for a moment, as if in reflection before smearing the wall with a scrawl that betters any kindergarten tantrum. My father threw a plate of spaghetti against the wall. The wall behaved with unflinching equanimity. However stricken, however much feelings were bruised, the wall, knowing its part, held its breath and maintained the countenance of the unfazed. I was 12 years old. My powers of observation were as keen as a china plate. I studied how the pasta suddenly loosened from its dinner plate, paused, and then began a slow descent. They say that if it is fully cooked, spaghetti sticks to the wall. I think my parents were fully cooked that night, for when the plate hit, they read the proverbial writing. My father raised himself from the head of the table and retreated to the bedroom. My mother withdrew to the den, where, lying on the couch, she feathered the pages of a magazine. Nothing any more dramatic ever happened in that house. I think they got it. I ate a few more bites of dinner and then went outside. I didn't need to be told at that moment it was okay to leave the table, leave the plates and silverware like so much prop and clutter. I'm not sure what was going on. My father closed the door to their bedroom. Later that evening, I saw him in bed reading by his small night table light, which featured him like a spotlight features a man whose life is neither small nor large. He is still alive, and though I sense he can tolerate contradiction, I don't think I'll ask him what happened that night. One time, in one of my more curious moments, I asked my mother where children come from. She was sitting on their bed and looked at me for as long as it took for me to sense that I was being seen. When she finally spoke, she said, "Two people have to be very close." And then, as if she sensed that the occasion warranted further explanation, she added, "And they have to be very lucky." I thought about what she said. I didn't know any more than I did before, but I had a good feeling. Later on, I would read a definition of modern poetry as the poem in the act of finding what would suffice, its past, a souvenir. That's how I keep the spaghetti, a souvenir, a distinction, the exception that proves the rule. I remember how it paused for a moment and then began its slow and savory descent to the dining room floor.
God, I love those lines from your mom, too, and you have to be lucky. Well, was that a memory that you had suddenly just remembered or had been simmering in you all these years and you just decided to write about it? Was it traumatic?
I think whenever you see a parent act out and you're young and you're vulnerable and you're just not sure what's going on, it's traumatic. I don't think I felt unsafe. And in some way, the poem is sort of cherishing them for not being perfect.
Yeah.
And what I particularly appreciate about people is when they know how to correct, when something's going off and they stop.
So
I saw that, you know, because we have emotions and that's what makes it interesting. And then when it got too big, I saw someone say, "Oh, that's it. I have to go to my room." I appreciated that, especially... in different incarnations of your life as a parent and as a partner as a friend, as a teacher. And so it was useful for me.
Are you an only child?
No, I have a younger brother.
Was your younger brother there when this happened?
You know, I don't remember him playing a big role. I don't know. That's a good question. I'll have to go back in my memory and see if I can.
Yeah, because I was wondering how he would react to that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll ask him.
You teach writing and poetry. Do you ever meet a student that has a really, really unique voice? Are you meeting people who are different kinds of writers than we normally see?
I meet students who understand poetry in a way which I feel is kind of precocious, who can tell stories right from the get-go. And they all sort of have their own sort of talents in terms of poetry. Some of them have these incredible, like, language facility, others imagination. But some of them have real insight into sort of, I don't know, the nature of our condition. And I try to tap into that just to encourage it, share what my own enthusiasms and respond to theirs. Before I had my first book published, someone told me they'd read some of my poems when I was in my early 30s and said, "You're going to have a book." And then he said, "But you're going to have to be 40. What do you mean?" But I see those intuitions and those strengths in my students, even though they're
And 20. Do most of them really want to be writers? They want to pursue it, or are they wanting to be teachers instead of pursuing a career? I mean, obviously poetry isn't some lucrative job that you're going to end up.
There's no money in poetry, no poetry in money. You know, I see less and less students who want to pursue a life of poetry. I don't think they perceive how it could work. It's sad in a way.
I was going to say,
my poetry classes are smaller and smaller.
Oh, it's a beautiful language. I hope it doesn't become a lost language,
Well, I think that everyone has a form of expression, and I think they're finding other forms.
And then, of course, we see poetry in a lot of things. I see poetry in paintings, and you see poetry in beautiful films, and,
I think the best way to preserve poetry is to have it on the radio.
I want to have you read another poem from the collection, speaking of preserving. This one is called 2 Days.
Yeah, I like this one. I actually use this expression twice in the book. I have another poem which recounts a moment I was in Ireland, Dun Angus, and I use this expression that I heard. A colleague of mine told me that the Spanish have an expression called life is 2 days. And I use it twice in this book.
You also use it in your
And I use it in my dedication to my son.
Yeah.
I said, for my son on the second day. So the other poem where I use this expression is Boiling Water. So it meant a lot to me. Because as soon as you sort of experience this moment of reflection, you're already in that second day. And it tells the truth that I like, that I can appreciate. It's sort of like the same understanding that comes along with the sense of a kind of fall. 2 days. The Spanish say that life is 2 days. On the first, I was to become a man and sat nervously beside the rabbi. If you were out there in the congregation, you might have seen me squirming up there by the podium, nearly paralyzed by the sight of my extended family, friends, and the rest of the congregation that stretched out like the Red Sea, a sea of ancestors past made present. It was an Orthodox temple on the turnpike, an Orthodox crowd, unharmonious in prayer, praying and swaying as the Orthodox do, bobbing and weaving to their own internal song, trading jabs with the Almighty. My friends sat in the front row like pinch hitters in a dugout, waiting and watching. It was a culmination of days. It was the first day. I wondered if when I opened my mouth to sing, anything would come out. No one was stopping me from getting up, putting down my talis and book, and walking out into the street and the quiet daylight where simple exchanges were being made on the boulevard. I could go into that pure light. It was my special day. I was wearing a suit which helped me keep my place. I'm not sure when the rabbi fell asleep. I looked over and his eyes were closed, in perfect repose. I wasn't sure if things were going well or not. I could imagine a God that might spare me the honor of singing before 200 people. By default of circumstance, I would be ushered into manhood through a side door and find myself on the other side, a man sitting by the rabbi. Without opening his eyes, he said quietly, "Go ahead." "What?" "Go ahead," he said, as one would gently shoo a fly through an open window. "Now?" "Yes," he said, with his eyes still closed. It turned out okay, the singing. A while after that passage, I left the temple with its high windows and black books. I was a teenager and then a young man. I had other lives to live. It was becoming the second day. One time, a few years later, I was home for a weekend. I remember sitting on the front steps of my parents' home, my hair rolling down my shoulders. I wore a t-shirt, shorts, and sneakers. It was a Saturday, the Sabbath. I saw an old man in a dark suit walking the sidewalk. A gray beard poured down from his face like a scroll. I stared for a long time, and then I found myself getting up, brushing myself off and going over to him. I was aware that I was living a life distinct from the one we imagined when I sat next to him years before. But somehow, I think, if my eyes were closed, I would have seen him, and I could not greet him. When I introduced myself, he was genuinely pleased, and we chatted for a moment. Before he continued on his walk, he took my hand a second time and thanked me for saying hello. It was one of those moments in which you sense that everything you thought about the world was wrong. It was summer. Cars and kids playing could be heard through the neighborhood. A slight breeze rustled in the trees. The world was quietly sleeping, quietly awake.
That's a beautiful one.
Thanks.
Don't you love that? It's very touching.
I like that final moment, yeah.
Yeah.
And again, I think the poem is about being surprised. Everything I thought was wrong. I like to sort of tiptoe up to my own understanding and see if I can go a little further. And that experience did it for me.
I love that poem. Are you going to continue writing in this vein? Are you going to have a second volume? It seems to me that this is something that's going to continue.
I think I'm going to continue writing in this more narrative form. I've actually thought about trying to write something that's in this form but longer. One of my favorite writers is a writer named Sonia Livingston, who wrote a book called Ghost Bread, and it's a novel in short pieces. They're sort of like flash pieces, and I think about that, telling story in those kinds of succinct packets where there's this sort of pleasure of understanding but maybe some more anticipation. I'm not a novelist. I don't usually make things up, but I can imagine how these different instances might accumulate into a larger work.
Well, you can call it an archaeological dig of Jerry.
All right.
So I know you won the National Mammoth Poetry Contest, and you've gotten 3 books published. Is this something that's going to continue? Or are you going to have to look for a new publisher, or are they going to just keep publishing
you? Oh, okay. So each time Tony Vallone published one of my works, subsequent to winning the award, I wasn't sure if he was going to be able to afford to do it or not, because small presses, have that challenge.
Yes.
But each time he did it, and I was gratified. I don't know if he read the work and said, yeah, I guess I'll publish this or not. But I don't know. So it was a question mark, but he's very supportive, and the press is really strong, I think, the writing that he publishes. So I'm confident. I don't think that much about that.
Yeah. But you do want to get your work out. I mean, everybody who writes doesn't want to just have it sit in the drawer.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful book, Jerry.
Well, thank you, Tish.
I'm so glad you published
it.
You have any contact information you can give people if they want to buy the book?
Yeah, I have a website. It's www.jerrymerskin.org. The book is available through the Mammoth website, which is www.mammothbooks.org. If you go on the site, you can order it directly. I think they have it at Buffalo Street Books, too.
Great. Well, Jerry Merskin, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called Crepuscular Non-Driveway. Go out and get it. It's a beautiful collection. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.